This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In the lead-up to the May 6th primary election, we're talking to congressional candidates from North Carolina's 2nd District. They include Frank Roach, Clay Aiken, Keith Crisco, Toni Morris, and incumbent Renee Elmers. Congresswoman Elmers has declined to come on this program. Today, we're talking with Democratic candidate Clay Aiken. Clay is best known, of course, for his appearance on American Idol and subsequent singing career, but he's also a longtime activist for children with special needs and now running for Congress. Clay Aiken, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you are best known for your work as an entertainer. What qualifies you to be a member of Congress?
Well, I think, you know, in my work as an entertainer has given me an opportunity to advocate for people for the past 11 years. You know, I started out as an educator in a classroom at Brentwood Elementary near North Raleigh. And I tried to use that I went to school to be a special ed teacher and have used my connection to kids with disabilities and my passion for working with children in general to try to advocate for kids for the past 11 years. So, you know, I think that's really what the job of a representative really should be, is to advocate for people in their district. It's not just to cast votes. It's to make sure that you're speaking up for the needs of the people around you. And I've done that for the past decade.
You have made a point of saying that you are not a politician. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think people are, heck, I am disenfranchised with the way politicians work. Even in the past 9 weeks of being in politics, you see that that it's not necessarily the public service type of environment that I kind of always dreamed and fantasized it was. You know, people are too often, I think, in politics in it because they want to be in positions of power. They want to be in they need a job, or I don't need a job. And I don't have any interest in doing this because of any other reason than I see people who are not being spoken up for and who are not being advocated for. And so when I say I'm not a politician, I mean I don't really want to be a part of that culture of constantly fighting with people and constantly needing to prove the other side wrong instead of doing something positive yourself.
Here's the thing. If you get elected, you go into Washington. There are professional politicians up there. If you claim not to be, then you don't know what you're doing because you're not playing the profession. You're not a professional in the way they are. Why should they take you seriously?
Well, you know, listen, folks who are up in Washington are not all politicians by trade. We have a lot of career politicians, and I think we have too many of career politicians. But we do have people up there who I believe are in the in public service instead of in politics. And those folks stand out to me. David Price is an example. Of course, he is a politician, but he is someone who I know and believe has shown up to work every day for the past almost 30 years because he wants to serve the people of the Triangle. I think there are certainly other congressmen and women up there who do the same thing. There is, of course, a need to know how to work with people. I've certainly been able to do that and navigated my career thus far by working with people. But I don't necessarily care to be the type of person who says one thing to one person and says the other thing to another person. There's way too much of that going on.
You are in a primary battle now, two opponents in this race, Keith Crisco and Toni Morris. What sets you apart?
Well, I mean, I think one especially, the idea that there are folks who have been public servants in the past and have a history of pandering to one side or the other. That is a trait that I don't think I possess and I don't care to. And I think in general, my history, like I said, of advocating for individuals speaks for itself in many ways. But at the same time, my mother always says, has always said, many people have said, if you always do what you've always done, you always get what you've always got. And we have got a lot of dysfunction and a lot of posturing and a lot of people standing in the corner and unwilling to compromise. It's a dirty word nowadays. That's sort of the politics of old, and I don't really necessarily subscribe to that. As far as the primary goes, I certainly have a lot of respect for folks who have been in politics for a long time. But politics for a long time have gotten us into a place that I don't think is healthy.
But I asked you to compare yourself to Keith Crisco and Toni Morris. You said something about some politicians pander. They've been at it too long. Do either or both of them fit that description? Is that who you're talking about?
I don't know that much about Toni. And what I know of Keith Crisco is that he's a very nice man. But, I don't necessarily think that what we need in this election right now is someone who has been in a Washington insider and a political insider for as long as he has been.
No, Washington insider?
Well, he was a White House fellow. He's been involved with several things in D.C., so he's not new to the scene necessarily, and I think that brings with it positives, but I think it also brings with it some substantial challenges.
He was also Secretary of Commerce in Bev Perdue's administration right here in the state. Now, you've spoken about issues of unemployment in your district. How do you bring more jobs?
I think one of the first ways to bring more jobs is to make sure that we address the educational system in the state and in the area. Some of that is a state issue. Some of it can only be advocated for by a congressman. But there are things that the federal government does that I think they need to kind of get out of the way a little bit and allow the local governments to do better, to be more creative and determine how we want to teach children. When you have an incredible when you have great educational opportunities, businesses want to come. That's one primary thing. I think one area where I differ from my primary opponents is I believe that we shouldn't be giving huge tax credits to companies who are shipping jobs overseas. We don't need to be incentivizing businesses who are taking jobs away from our state and our area.
Well, the theory is that they're bringing, if you incentivize them, they will move to your state and bring those jobs right here.
Well, in some cases, certain incentives do that. And I'm not against incentives in general, but tax breaks, especially federal tax breaks that give you cuts for moving, being able to write off moving expenses for sending jobs overseas. The federal government itself has not been able to, Congress has not been willing or able to commit itself to only buying from companies that don't ship jobs overseas. The government should be setting an example, and I don't believe that that we need to be having a tax code that makes it so easy for larger corporations to pay minuscule taxes, and yet working class Americans don't have access to those loopholes and those tax breaks.
So we still have a public education system in this country, and it's paid for by tax dollars. This state legislature just cut taxes, and it will probably amount to something like $500 million loss to the Treasury here, and we're struggling to pay teachers. Do we have to raise taxes? And I'm talking about the state level here, but also at the national level. Are you willing at the national level to raise taxes to pay for public amenities that you've just said are important to the fundamental structure and infrastructure of the United States?
I think there are ways that we can raise revenue without taxing the middle class anymore. I think there are ways that we can raise revenue without needing to take money away from working Americans who are already paying more than their fair share. There are certainly folks who aren't necessarily paying a big fair share. And I talked about it a little bit a second ago when I talked about companies who are getting huge tax breaks. Closing some of these loopholes is not necessarily raising taxes. It's simply requiring people to pay the taxes that I'm paying and everyone else in the country is paying. And so we can raise revenue in those ways, and I think we should do that.
You have a sizable military population in your district. It's been affected by the budget cuts and rates of unemployment. What would you do to help support the military population?
Well, in I break those two populations down into two sections. You've got active duty military and you've got veterans. Veterans unemployment in this state is 4 points higher than the average unemployment rate, and their proposals that have been on the table to give tax credits to companies who hire veterans. Those proposals, which really should be bipartisan. I mean, first of all, it's a tax cut and a tax credit in some ways, so some people should be happy with it. And it's certainly a bipartisan issue. Everyone recognizes that the people who put their life on the line for us, we need to take better care of. So, but issues like that. Proposals that should be bipartisan are sitting on the table, gathering dust because people are standing in one corner or the other with their arms crossed, not willing to give either side a win. And we've got to break that culture somehow. We also need to be more diligent when we take care in taking care of veterans. When it comes to the inefficiencies in the VA, there's a lot of capital that's up here in Durham. When it comes to equipment and trained professionals and doctors, and they're not all accessible to those veterans who are in Cumberland County and Hope County and Harnett County and Moore County around Fort Bragg, who have to drive to Fayetteville in order to who have to drive to Durham in order to get care. I believe we should start by moving a lot of those resources down to the population center where we have more veterans and we have more military. And then additionally, folks who are living outside of Fayetteville shouldn't have to. If you're living in, and again, if you're living in Randolph County, you shouldn't have to drive an hour and a half to Fayetteville or to Durham if you're a veteran to get medical care. And we need to be providing access.
You talked about a specific program that would allow more portability without expanding VA facilities, right?
Right. I mean, I think that there needs to be a discussion about it. Do I have all the answers to it? No. Do I have every number? Of course not. But there probably needs to be a discussion about the VA's role in medical care versus the VA's role in medical coverage. And right now, the VA handles a lot of care itself. And while they're getting, I believe they get good care, it's not accessible to people. So if veterans had more access to it, it might require the VA to spend more of its resources on coverage versus care.
You concerned about the national debt? And if so, what do we do about it?
Listen, I'm concerned about all types of debt, whether it be, I think that debt can be. You know, in order to get credit, you got to have some debt, right? But so I think it has a value to it. But I think we need to be more efficient with the way that we spend money and the reasons we borrow money. You know, there's what I think $25 billion or so, give or take some. I may get the number a little bit wrong, but $25 billion a year that's spent on maintaining federal facilities that are unused or vacant. We don't need to look just for places to cut. We need to look for places where we can spend smarter. And so we talk about the debt, and I think the debt is a frighteningly high number. That said, when you look at deficits, you look at the fact that you take out a loan in order to put your child through college. And the reason you do that is you're investing in your child. You know that if you take out a loan and you invest in your child's education, that will pay off in the future because your child will be able to get a better job, hopefully, a higher paying job. You're not balancing your budget that year when you take out that loan. You're going into debt, but that debt is an investment. And if we're using our money in responsible ways, building and strengthening our infrastructure, not just roads and bridges, but the electrical grid, broadband access. If we're spending money in those ways, not only are we putting people to work, but we're investing in the future, and our roads are what it takes to get goods and services to market. So debt is something that we should not continue to be racking up at the rate we're racking it up. But we can solve that problem by spending smarter, I think.
What do you think about the Affordable Care Act?
I think that the tenets and the motivation for the basic tenets and the basic motivation for the Affordable Care Act is very sound and valuable. Making sure that people have access to health care, making sure it's affordable for them, making sure that it's available regardless of whether or not they've had a pre-existing condition or whether they're sick right now. Those are important things that we must be continuing to do. That said, there are still a lot of parts to that law that are causing a lot of people a lot of problems, whether it be folks who still cannot quite afford it, or whether it be businesses that are not able to provide health care to all their employees. And there are parts of the law that we've got to address. I think that there are people who happen to be on my side of the aisle sometimes who are not willing to recognize the fact that there are some problems.
What are the problems and how would you fix them?
Well, I mean, I think we've got to look at, for example, let's see, one of the ratios between the most expensive health care coverage and the least expensive coverage is right now, I think, 3-1. There are proposals to expand that to 5-1, which, of course, would allow health care to be less expensive for some people and hopefully would get people into the pool. I think it's important that we take a look at something like that. It seems like a very smart proposal, and we really need to stop being in the corner and crossing our arms and not considering it. I think that the individual mandate, of course, has a lot of folks who up in arms and it has upset people for reasons. I think that it's important that as many people get access to coverage and as many people get covered as absolutely possible. And for that reason, I recognize the importance of something like a mandate in order to keep this access to health care coverage available for everybody. But I don't necessarily believe that the government needs to be telling people what types of coverage they're buying. I think that we probably need to give people more freedom when it comes to what do I want covered? Do I want a higher deductible? Do I want a lower copay? How do I? And those edges need to be sanded down some. Some of them need to be rounded off. And there's a lot of them. But at the same time, I must say, we have to do a better job, which, I mean, I think the folks who proposed and were proponents of the healthcare law in the first place really did a poor job of explaining all the great things that it brings to the table. You know, we talk a lot about 26-year-olds not being able to stay on their parents' coverage. We talk about the fact that you can't be kicked off if you're sick. But we don't talk about a lot of other great provisions. You know, doctors prescribing you medications because they're being paid by pharmaceutical companies to promote a specific medication, that has been curtailed with this law. Insurance companies now have to spend 80% of what you pay them on your care, not on bonuses for executives. That's a really responsible part of the law. Hospitals can't just charge you for something and not tell you what it is that they're charging you for. $50 for a $4 bag of saline, they have to let you know what they're charging you. There are a lot of provisions in this very long law that are universally praised and accepted, and we haven't done a good enough job, I believe, of making sure everyone knows what's in here that's positive.
Your Republican opponents have been outspoken about immigration reform. How do you feel about that?
There are several ways I break that down as well. The Dream Act. I'm a staunch supporter of the Dream Act. Children who have been children, young adults who were brought here to this country through no fault of their own, should not be penalized, should not be punished. We've educated them. They have paid into this economy. They've invested in this country, and they are functioning members of society. They need to be functioning citizens as well. We need to let them stay here. When it comes to adults, let's look at the fact that we've got 11, 12 million people here who are living living here illegally. Even the idea, the thought that we would be able to round up everyone who's here illegally and send them back to the country they came from is, to me, somewhat preposterous. I mean, I'll come right out and say it. It would cost hundreds of billions of dollars to do that for folks who are. It's interesting that the folks who are proposing that are the ones who are trying to be fiscally responsible also, or saying that they're fiscally responsible also. And I that's irresponsibility if you ask me. So those folks who are here are not going to be deported, and so we have to figure out how we can continue to get them out of the shadows, make sure that they can get jobs, they can pay into the economy. There are a lot of agriculture in this state. There's a lot of farming and a lot of farmers who would like to be able to use workers for jobs legally. So we need to make sure that they're able to stay here legally. Now, what the path is between where the gray area is between how do you stay here legally and when you can become a citizen, I don't have the timeline for it. I don't know. But to ask people to be a part, they're paying into our society. They're part of the economy. They're an important part of the economy. You know, taking that many people out of the economy would be incredibly detrimental. So they have to be able to stay here legally. And I believe that they need to be able to be fully functioning members of society, and therefore they will need to at some point be able to vote, which requires that we give them a pathway to citizenship.
If you win the nomination, you'll be running against Renee Elmers, perhaps. She is now the incumbent. She is also facing a primary challenge, so it isn't certain. But it's a conservative district nonetheless. You'll be running against a Republican. You've only got about 30 seconds for this one, but what sets you apart, and how will you run that campaign in what is a very conservative district now?
Well, I'm doing this not because I want a job, like I said. I'm doing it because I want to serve people, and I want to be an advocate for folks who are not being listened to. And I think they're not being listened to by the current incumbent. I think they're not being advocated for by the current incumbent. You only gave me 30 seconds, so I can't do too much more, but I think that's really the headline. I think the headline is that while it may be a somewhat perceived to be a conservative district, it's a district of people who recognize the motivations behind a lot of people who are in Washington and Raleigh and in public service in general. And I have made it very clear, I think, through actions that my goals here are not to be not necessarily to be a congressperson, but to make sure I represent people.
Clay, thank you very much. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Clay Aiken, a singer and a longtime activist for children with special needs and also a candidate for the Democratic primary in the 2nd Congressional District in North Carolina. He's running against Keith Crisco and Toni Morris in that primary. Just ahead, the secret world of Dr. Seuss. Stay tuned.